The American leadership understood that the problem with a kingdom was that one man had virtually absolute power and discretion regarding the operation of the kingdom, and they recognized absolute power corrupts absolutely. These American leaders had to come up with a structure where the office of king was divided, and where no one division of the office of king could establish control. Thus, the office of king was divided and became three separate departments over which no one person or group of persons could control the entire office of king. The American leaders further determined that the people must retain the sovereignty, and that the sovereignty not be delegated wholesale to the government, with very limited exceptions. These concepts can be researched in the publications known as the Federalist Papers, the numerous letters back and forth between the various leaders of the colonies and the delegates to the various conventions, their memorandums, and other communications between the several founders of our national government. While there was much discussion about how much power would be delegated, the major substance of the discussions was on how to structure the government in a manner that would provide the greatest degree of protection against abuse of the office of government by those elected or appointed to operate its several departments. This new government is republican in form. That alone is not enough. For example, the People's Republic of China is republican in form. However, its constitution, as adopted by its people at the time, granted substantial and nearly unlimited powers to government and put virtually all power in the hands of a central committee. Communist Russia was republican in form. Just look at the name, USSR, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, where their constitutions granted government virtually unlimited power. Just because a government is organized in the form of a republic does not provide the people any specific protections, except that the government does not change its laws based upon the democratic principle of mob rule by the whims of the simple majority. The government is constrained to the terms and conditions of the Constitution organizing it, and any substantial changes must be made as provided in its organizing instrument, generally referenced as a constitution. So how did our founding fathers determine how to put this together? The new American Republic. It was organized with a lot of planning, but the actual organization occurred from AD 1789 through 1791. The founders wanted to structure a republic where the people and their individual colony states, while retaining individual sovereignty, could obtain the protections of a central government in interstate and foreign commerce, national security, and domestic violence. These founders devised a three-department government, meeting both the form and substance of a republic and being aggregate in form. All powers delegated to this government are limited to the express terms of the delegations of authority in the Constitution and are restrained to only those powers expressly delegated. There are two sets of beneficiaries to this new central government: the several colony states, and the people of those several states, as well as the people who may inhabit the territory the central government must govern to be recognized in international law, the people of the District of Columbia. The legislative department of this new government was also structured in an aggregate form. Congress itself was developed in aggregate form by division into two separate houses. The House of Representatives was structured to act in the best interests of the people of the several colony states. However, the House of Representatives cannot make any law on its own authority, but it can prevent any law that is not in the best interest of the people of the several states from being passed. The Senate was structured to act in the best interests of the several colony states. However, the Senate cannot make any law on its own authority, but can prevent any law which is not in the best interest of the several states from being passed. This structure made it impossible for either set of beneficiaries to be deemed, in international law, to be beneficiaries and also in control of the legislative department of government. Aggregate. Neither the people nor the several states could be held liable for the obligations of the national government as approved by Congress. That has subsequently been changed, and now even the Senate is elected directly by the people, converting Congress into a soul of the people, and therefore anything Congress agrees to is directly binding upon the people, because it is their alter ego. The entire government does not suffer that disability yet. However, we have seen moves in the last few years to try and change that. The executive department of government, we call it president, was also structured to be aggregate in form. The president has no authority to make any law. While the president may exercise his veto power, Congress may override the veto, and thus the president has no authority to even prevent any law from being passed. The president is a pure subject, ordained to carry out or execute the duties delegated by the Constitution and to execute the laws passed by Congress. The president does handle the everyday execution of the laws and thus has a say in the day-to-day operations of government and therefore must, to maintain aggregate form, not be directly elected by the people or appointed or elected by the several states. This was accomplished through the organization of a third party, the Electoral College, who independently appointed by its internal election the president. Again, neither the people nor the several states have any direct say or control in the selection of the president, maintaining pure aggregate form. The third department of government is judicial. The president appoints the judicial department's officers. However, the president does not have control of who becomes judicial officers. The Senate must approve the president's proposed appointee. The Senate cannot control who becomes a judicial officer, but may prevent anyone from becoming a judicial officer. Again, pure aggregate form, where no beneficiary, either people or the several states, has a direct say in who the judicial officers are or how they perform their day-to-day duties. Now let's look at the beneficiaries. Let's start with the several states. The several states agreed, by way of the federal constitution, which in reality and international law is simply a treaty or a contract, at Article 6, that every officer of those several states and the United States, the federal government, are required before entering upon the duties of office to execute an oath or affirmation contract agreeing to uphold the federal constitution and laws. This is a private contract between the individual holding the office and the government, enforceable by either the government or the beneficiaries. Each of the several states' legislative bodies have also organized municipal corporations for the purpose of providing and obtaining various services. For example, in 1889, Washington was admitted to the Union. On December 23, 1889, the Washington legislature organized a municipal corporation styled a Supreme Court, whose process name, or DBA, is State of Washington. This municipal corporation was given the duty as trustee to the transition from territorial to state government. It is directed by the legislation to take possession of the books and records of the territory, and two, upon the offices of the state being filled, turn over the books and records of the territory to the new state's offices. The Supreme Court has yet to find any of the offices of the new state to be staffed, and continues to this day to be trustee of the state's books and records, and to provide provisional governmental services until the people fill the offices of the state. Additionally, the Supreme Court Corporation has offered other services to those who choose to contract for such services. If you will research your state's legislative history, you will find similar legislation organizing a statewide municipal corporation that is offering various services and products in consideration of various taxes and exactments. Each of these municipal corporations has been granted the power to provide and obtain services by contract. Now let's look at the people, the other beneficiary of the national government. The people, being sovereigns, are deemed to know the law. The boss always is deemed to know what the law of the organization is. The founding fathers pointed out, "We have given you a republic if you can keep it." The founding fathers went on to advise us of what it takes to accomplish that goal. Know the law and be well disposed to use it. Since the sovereign people, as the ultimate power and authority, are presumed to know their own law, it is deemed by the courts that everyone has knowingly and intelligently chosen their contracts and obligations and knows who and what they are dealing with in every activity. The sovereign people are deemed to understand their contracts and to have knowingly and intelligently chosen and negotiated the contracts to which they are parties. The people, routinely not wanting to take responsibility, continue to demand that government provide services not authorized by the constitutions. They cannot do this through the Republican government that was established. So how do public officials who want to get reelected by appeasing the people's demands provide the people what they want without violating the Constitution? This is done through municipal corporations. Let's start by looking at the national level, the District of Columbia and the territories. The Constitution provides that Congress has the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States. In 1871, Congress exercised this power by legislating the organization of a municipal corporation to run the day-to-day affairs of the District of Columbia, the seat of government. The proper name of this municipal corporation is United States. Congress adopted the text of the federal constitution as the constitution or charter of this municipal corporation. This municipal corporation was granted the power to contract to provide municipal services to the inhabitants of the District of Columbia, and necessarily as an operation of the Privileges and Immunity Clause of Article 4 of the Constitution, any other person who chooses to contract for its services. Congress has similarly provided for the organization of municipal corporations to provide services for the inhabitants of the several territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, U.S. Virgin Islands, Northern Mariana Islands, etc. Each of these municipal corporations has been granted the power to provide and obtain services by contract. Again, we're looking to find how these officials can get reelected by appeasing the people's demand for services that the Constitution does not allow the Republic to provide. Each municipal corporation, whether federal or at the state level, provide three separate and distinct areas of services. First, these municipal corporations are providing essential governmental services. They perform the functions of executive, legislative, and judicial departments of their respective governments through their several branches. While performing this function, the municipal corporation, and each of its officers, is required to be bound by the applicable constitutions. These officers are bound because of the oath affirmation contract requirement at Article 6 of the Federal Constitution. This is where a remedy may be found when the individual officers of the municipal corporation violate the Constitution while in the capacity of providing these essential governmental services. However, to obtain the remedy, you must know the law and, more importantly, be well disposed to use it. If you do not know how to enforce the law is absolutely useless. If it appears that you do not meet the qualifications of a sovereign, knowing the law and being well disposed to use it, you are deemed to be a ward of the court and be represented by the state's officer, an attorney, who in conjunction with the court has the duty to protect you and your fellow members of society from your incompetence. The second separate function of these municipal corporations is to provide property management services relating to the property of the government. This includes management of the buildings, motor vehicles, record systems, parks, and providing police, an acronym for policy enforcement, services, etc. In this function, the municipal corporation's powers and authorities are similar to any private person acting in a proprietary capacity. The third separate function of these municipal corporations is the capacity to offer and market various benefits and services of a non-governmental nature, outside the scope of what can be offered by the Republic, organized and constrained by the constitutions. These benefits are private business activities controlled exclusively by the terms and conditions of the contract offering. The only constitutional provision governing these contract services is the constitutional prohibition on the impairment of the obligations of contracts you find at Article 1, Section 10. In this section, nearly all of the social services and benefits programs, professional and vehicle licensing, and permit processes, regulatory services, etc., are provided. What is the governing law, and how should that be applied? These municipal corporations are governed under their charters. However, they are also subject to Article 14, an amendment to the Federal Constitution. This 14th Amendment did several things. It provided that those who were not born free men would be recognized as an operation of law to have the same equal rights as those born free. The unstated qualifier is that to exercise these rights, they must know the law and be well disposed to use it. They must learn law and procedure. They must know and understand the contracts they choose to participate in, and where appropriate, negotiate those contracts to their best interest rather than just accepting those contracts as offered. In the 1860s, there were many, many former slaves around who were given equal protection of the law, not inherently recognized as having rights, but due to their newly free status, Article 14, an amendment, provided them equal protection of the law as if they had been born free. However, most of these former slaves did not know the law and were incompetent to engage in commerce, even though they now had standing to do so. Now that everyone, free man and former slave alike, have equal rights, the free man may choose to accept benefits in exchange for consideration, just as the former slave may. Most of these former slaves did not know how to go out in the world, organize and run a business, and therefore looked back to their former masters for opportunities. Many of the former slaves immediately exercised their newly acquired contract rights to become sharecroppers, contracting to work for a share of the crop proceeds. Of course, the landowners knew the law and contracts and wrote contracts very beneficial to the host plantation and not very favorable to the sharecropper. The next contract offering was for credit at the company store. With a proviso in the contract, the contracted sharecropper may not cancel the contract when there is an outstanding balance due at the company store. Of course, the prices at the company store, with the financing charges, and the structure of the sharecrop compensation plan generally work together to prevent the sharecropper from ever getting out of debt to the company store and having the standing to cancel the sharecrop contract and move on to more lucrative opportunities. Does this sound much like a corporate job today? Does it sound like self-imposed servitude? You may very well be right. Due to much activism regarding the unconscionable contracts to which sharecroppers had subjected themselves, and other substantial disparities in contract labor situations, the municipal corporations began offering alternative benefits programs in consideration for other obligations. The essential governmental services side of the municipal corporations enacted statutes preventing state charter corporations or any other state-licensed business from participating in such unconscionable labor contracts, while at the very same time creating the public policy encouraging every business to partake of the benefits of the commercial side of the municipal corporations in consideration for waiver of their unlimited right to contract. All of this information is very profound, for many of you very, very new, and for many probably almost unbelievable. But more important than that is, how do we use this knowledge in our everyday lives to exercise our sovereignty?